All right, everybody, welcome back in. Week 9 of college football, as we count it, with me and Brent Rollins, who works for PFF and writes for Rivals. As we have it right now, 34 teams as of week 9, first year in the playoff, that are still alive, which is really
technically
cool, which is why we like the expanded playoff, Brent, right? Like, just there's so many more games that matter still at this point that we can get into.
And a lot of fan bases still have some level of hope. But first, I saw a little something on Twitter where a guy who just had a 3-sack game and maybe the biggest win of the season, Georgia at Texas, and you were kind of messing with him, showing him pass rush stuff. Like, why would you be doing that with somebody that just had 3 sacks in a game?
Maybe he was showing
me. Jalen Walker, by the way.
Okay, maybe he was teaching me, but not. Yeah, went to Coach Rick's bowling thing for charity tonight, and all the UGA players were there, and Jalen Walker was there, and definitely we talked shop, man, for like a solid 10 minutes. Just he was picking my brain about stuff, and we were just talking pass rush, and it was super cool. Like, you know me, you're the same way. Brent is a coach. Yeah. He's a nerd. Like, I'm a nerd, like football nerd. I love thought processes and things to get into. First game, what do you want to get into first? LSU A&M.
Big one. Back to Texas, LSU at A&M, back to the state of Texas, that is.
Number one and number two teams in the SEC.
So let's think about that first, though. Both of these teams, both teams lost a non-conference game in the first game of the season.
Yep.
Both are undefeated in the SEC, like you said. Both have a top 10 win at home against the then-ranked number 9 team. LSU beat Ole Miss when they were 9th. A&M beat Mizzou when they were 9th. So, I think first off, you got to start with the home team with A&M and the job that Mike Elko's done coming in there.
Yeah, and not surprised. And I say that because when you look at what Mike Elko did at Duke with less, I had very little concern that he was going to do a lot more at A&M with all those resources. You know, it's a team that I'd buy stock in moving forward because of him. No nonsense, coach's ball, coach's energy, coach's effort, defensive savant, experience in the league in the SEC after coaching all those years at A&M. So I'm not surprised. And by the way, his D-line will decide this game. Like, Scorton and company versus a very good LSU offensive line will go a long way in determining the outcome, because Nussmeier is elite. Nussmeier and we're gonna talk to Todd McShay in a little bit, and I already talked to him, and I'm gonna throw this out there now and later, because to me it's the truth. Nussmeier's the best quarterback in the SEC, and Nussmeier might be the top quarterback in this draft class. Like, the dude's been unbelievable, and I think LSU getting the run game going a little bit, and more importantly, their defensive side of the ball, Brent, like, they're getting it together. I wrote this down. Last 6 quarters, they've given up 1 touchdown. They've turned the ball over at a high rate. They played Ole Miss, by the way, in that stretch. It wasn't just Arkansas. This defense is starting to really come together.
Yeah, when you think about the defense, you know, new defensive coordinator, Baker, that just came over from Lake Baker, Missouri, yeah. who was at LSU for a moment and then went to Missouri and then is now back at LSU. They're getting better each and every week. It's like watching it on tape. It's very much a bend but don't break kind of, and then create turnovers. Like, they're allowing 71% completion. So it's not like it's just locked down everywhere, but you've got 2 edge guys in Swenson and Jones.
Yep.
And then Whit Weeks is playing his absolute tail off. I know you've had to game plan and coach against him.
Coached against him in high school. The best high school player we've played both sides of the football. I mean, just an animal at linebacker and an animal at tailback. Actually, an animal everywhere on the field, but continue.
Yeah, I agree. Animal after he creates turnovers and he does the swig celebration.
Solid.
But what was interesting watching against Arkansas, after the almost 90 plays they played against Ole Miss, it was down to like 50. Against Arkansas. So it wasn't like a grind game as they get ready for this game. But that they just each and every week, they keep getting better. And when you think about what they have to go against A&M's offense, the enigma that is Connor Wegman. I can give you some numbers here. Under pressure, he has the fourth best passing grade in the FBS. Clean pocket, he has the 3rd worst. Like, usually those numbers are completely flipped. Usually you get worse under pressure. So it's which Wegman are you going to get? Good Wegman, bad Wegman?
And that's why coming into the season, I thought he'd be the number one quarterback in this class over Beck, over Ewers, is because I thought he had the best feel for the pocket of anybody and played to his strengths and moved and rushed when he needed to and knew his answers. But yeah, it's kind of been a mixed bag. I think he'll do fine. But the defense for me for LSU, the thing is they're not an elite pass defense in the back end. And that goes to your 71%. They don't cover great. Now, since they got Zy Alexander back, they're better last couple of weeks. And he clearly makes them a lot better. They moved Ryan from corner to safety. But the biggest thing to me, without Harold Perkins Jr., which is an interesting point of itself, first three games, 380 yards a game, 27 points a game. Last three, 358 yards a game, 15 points a game. And Ole Miss was in that stretch, who's one of the best offenses. Yeah. So they're getting more pressure on the quarterback. They're turning the football over. They're getting better. And if that continues to improve with this offense, LSU is very much in play for this whole thing because Nussmeier is one of the best quarterbacks in the country, point blank, period. So I like LSU, homie, because it's tough atmosphere to go into Kyle Field. That is not easy. And if they had a different quarterback that wasn't named Nussmeier, I would give them a big chance to win. But I do think this. I think A&M's really, really good. I think A&M's pass defense, there's some holes. There's some areas over the middle of the field that I expect LSU, Nussmeier, healthier weapons out wide, more of a rapport to continue to do well and to win this football game.
So I was doing some other work for a team and had to go back and look at some 2019 LSU. And if you actually look at this season's offense with LSU, from a formational standpoint, how they create matchups, and especially in the RPO game, watch the footwork from Joe Burrow in 2019, how he runs the offense versus the footwork that Nussmeier is doing right now. It's carbon copy. Like, there's so many things from a scheme and whatnot with what they're doing right now that they're mimicking from that 20. Now, obviously, they don't have the playmakers and Jamar Chase and Jefferson, all that. Don't have that.
No.
But how it looks and scheme-wise, they're bringing a lot of that back, which is obviously a complete flip from what they had with Jaden Daniels and the split zone game that they had with him, all the QB run, that kind of stuff.
Complete flip. But here's where I say Joe Burrow and Nussmeier, I have no problem making this comparison. Feel in the pocket. Nussmeier's been pressured 65 times, one sack. He understands where to go with the football. He'll change arm angles. He'll get it out. Like, he's got some onions, man. Like, some real deal. He's made of all the right stuff. So that's why I like
it. I agree. By the way, I think LSU does end up winning this game.
All right, 2 for 2. All right.
So, yeah. All right, so we got a lot of other good games. Wouldn't necessarily say big-time matches, but a lot of ranked matchups. First off, number one team comes back home, Oregon, gets Illinois. Now, they're a 3-touchdown favorite, but, you know, this is still one of those games where, okay, you got to show up, basically, I think.
Yeah, and here's the thing with this game. This is the last top 25 team on Oregon's schedule, which says something. So I think if they win this game, they're already in the playoffs. And you might argue they might be in the playoffs regardless from what they've done so far. But I really like what Illinois has done. They deserve a ton of credit for what they've done. Altmaier getting so much better this year. Like, they lost their top guys from a year ago, and they go in the transfer portal and they get a receiver. And then Pat Bryant, who's a legit,
takes a leap.
Dude, he takes a huge step. He's 6'3". He's a big vertical guy on the outside that makes huge plays. They got Franklin that makes plays over the middle. It's weird, man. Illinois is a passing team. Like, they throw the football, and Altmaier has thrown the football. And last week, man, he wasn't crazy in the stat column at all. I don't even think he broke 100 yards. Like, it was that kind of a low game against Michigan. Pressured a lot. Another thing, Brent, 10 carries for 60 yards. His mobility, too, continues to show up. Altmaier can run the football enough. Last two games, 20 carries. So I do like that. And then the other side, Illinois, extremely aggressive. They like to bring blitzes. They like to be aggressive. That is not a good recipe against Oregon because Gabriel is in year 762 in the offense, in college football, excuse me. And he's got answers to man. Like, ask Ohio State how that worked for Tez. Ask him how it worked for Stewart on the outside. So I think there's a couple fun things to look for. But I don't have any doubts in Oregon and them winning the football game.
Yeah, I agree. Did you like Illinois' uniforms, by the way?
The helmet was one of the dopest looks I've seen. The helmet made the outfit for me. Like, that look, they looked like they were wearing old school leather helmets, man. I loved it.
Okay. The pants, I did not. Helmet, yes. The other part, no. Speaking of interesting matchups, all right. There's a team that just lost a big game and played Georgia, and then the next week has to go on the road and play the first time ranked in 11 years, Vandy, by the way. That happened to Alabama last time. That didn't go so well when they went to Nashville. Texas goes to Vandy.
And I don't have anything like really big Texas to look at in this game. Because obviously I think they're going to win the football game and they're going to be a big favorite for a reason. But I'll say this, the QB spot is going to be just so interesting now moving forward Sark made this decision. And when you pull your guy, man, and his name's Manning, like, you're going to get so much of that. It's going to be a big part of it. So that to me is a big deal. And then I think Brent, and I'll give it to you, Texas's defense bouncing back from not the greatest performance. They weren't the reason they lost, but Pavia's a stud. He's a gamer. And Vanderbilt does one thing really, really well. They will convert on third downs and they will control the flipping clock. Like, they will eat it up, let it go all the way down. They've stayed aggressive against Bama trying to pull the upset. I know they'll stay aggressive. So I think it could be an entertaining game.
Yeah, which, interesting enough, I heard Greg McElroy on his podcast, who I think you're going to talk to a little bit later, but talk about when your backup is has sort of rock star status, I think was the quote he used. It makes that move very interesting. And that's just, it's going to be fascinating to watch, because not only did he make the move, Sark said in like the interview, Quinn needed to calm down. Like, a guy who started for multiple years, he needed to take a break. Like, that was an interesting comment to make. But all right, so let's go to the other team that has had issues with Vanderbilt, and that's Alabama. Missouri, this is a true almost elimination game, I think, from a playoff standpoint. We talked about all these teams that are still alive. Whoever loses this game, I think, gets knocked off that list. So Missouri at Bama this weekend.
And all I want to see from Bama is their vertical passing game has disappeared the last couple weeks. Since Georgia, you know, the second half when I think Georgia did a really good job of saying, okay, minus late in the game to Ryan Williams, you know, take away the deep shots. That's what he does well. I'm okay with him doing the underneath stuff. The last couple weeks, same blueprint against Alabama. And so Milroe, I think he's less reluctant to run as he has been, because I think he's been getting hit over and over and he looks like he's been a little bit fatigued. So I'm really just looking at the offense and Milroe, can he get it out? Can he make plays? Can he be consistent? Because he's had a lot of ups and downs with that, I think, along the way. And then Missouri, man, Cook, heroic, bounce back, going to the hospital, coming back. But the offense hasn't looked right all year long for Missouri. No. And I Brent, if you got numbers or something or some reason why with all this tape study and stuff you do, I don't get it, because they've got weapons with Weiss and Green Beckham – or not Pink Green Beckham Jr. Wow, that was several years ago. Another highly recruited Missouri guy. But Luther Burton and Noel in the backfield. I think they got so many pieces. I feel like they should be better.
I agree. And now what's interesting, I heard – Coach Drink on, I think it was Feinbaum maybe, talking about how they had basically almost overcoached in a way, brought too much to the plate. And that when you do that, oftentimes your players don't play fast and play free. And I think he said, all right, we're getting back to just simplifying and playing fast and free. So maybe that changes a little bit. But I do think this is one where, especially because of the Missouri struggles from a pass defense standpoint, Alabama gets back on track. And I think for the playoffs,
Bama at home, obviously, dude, home and away is so different. Tennessee, you could tell that it had an effect on the game, like it always does. All right, I love this about you, Brent. Like, you do all the charting for PFF, and you watch so much tape for Rivals and your stuff. All right, you broke down Navy's offense. Like, give me the breakdown of what they do, why it's effective, and why they got a chance against Notre Dame.
Because it's the perfect blend of triple option and then spread concepts. And what's most amazing about it is they come out and they'll be in their sort of tight formation looking to run the triple option. And like against Memphis specifically, Charlotte, not as much, they didn't have as much chance offensively, but Memphis, the best team they played, they'd come in, they'd get into a tight set. They'd run, you know, have a two tech, zero tech, two tech, every, you know, 8-man, 9-man box. And then all of a sudden Navy spreads just out. And then it's one back, they're running jet read, they're running play action, they're running, it's phenomenal to watch. It's so much fun because of the misdirection. Your head is always on a swivel as a defender. And the other thing that's amazing watching them is from a blocking standpoint, all the things that you teach at the most basic level from a blocking standpoint of angles, where your head's supposed to be, knowing where the football is going, all those things, they do them extremely well. And they have holes upon holes. It's just a matter of, can they physically hold up against somebody like Notre Dame that's a lot more talented?
Well, and here's the thing. Why do they do it so well? Why is their system so good? These kids are there every year. They're not transferring out. They're in this system. They don't take transfers in. They don't leave. They don't have NIL. Like, the continuity for these service squads is elite. It is guys that are in the system year after year being developed. You throw in these option principles. By the way, most coaches, if they know they're facing an option team, Brent, in college, they practice one period a day on option. One period a day, because it is such a pain in your arse. Because it basically makes you play so smart, so disciplined. It, in a way, it's man-to-man principles. Like, it's literally, I've got quarterback. I've got pitch. Like, it makes it very difficult to play, you know, as good of team defense and everybody swarming to the football because everybody is so assignment driven. So throwing the spread
and the throw game,
throwing all this stuff that works together now, it makes it really hard to defend. But the difference to me in this game, Brent, is Navy has to play defense. If Navy had to play offense, I'd say Navy can win. And I think Navy can win this football game. But Navy is not a huge defensive line. They're not throwing in a bunch of 320-pounders that can stop the run. Notre Dame is going to run the football. Jeremiah Love is elite. He's a really good back. He's one of the best in the country at breaking tackles. Every time he touches the football, every other time he's going to break a tackle. He's that good. Like, and the stats kind of back it up with his numbers. And their offensive line has gotten better. Riley Leonard is in his lane because he knows he's a running quarterback. And so I think we've got two offenses that can score a lot of points, but I'm going to lean Notre Dame just because Navy has to play defense as well.
Yeah, I agree. That's the hard part when you watch them. But the Horvath at QB, he already has 10 touchdown passes. 13 is the school record. So he's going to break that, and that makes it even tougher. I think Notre Dame's just solid everywhere, and that's why they're going to be, I think, take care of business here. That number of teams that potential playoff, I can't think. Remember if I included Liberty in that, but I can't anymore because Kennesaw State just beat them.
They gone. Hey, and Liberty's been struggled all year. Like, they have not been the same squad that we're accustomed to seeing.
All right, so a lot of other sort of important but maybe not as marquee games starts Thursday night. Syracuse at Pitt. Syracuse 6-0 for the first time since 1982 with Dan Marino. I actually kind of like the Cuse, the orange, in this game.
Well,
I do.
And you like the Cuse because of Kyle McCord and his ability. Man, I can't believe what I've seen from him this year and his transformation, because I thought he was the thing that was holding back Ohio State a year ago. Literally, I was like, you got receivers, you got a running back, you got a good offensive line, like the quarterback's holding this back. And he goes to Syracuse and he's the reason they're thriving. And like, the deep ball is elite. He's shown you everything he has needed to show you this season. So I understand why you say that, but I will say this, man, after covering this game for a long time, Narduzzi is an aggressive sucker, man. Like, he will come after you. He will come for your jugular. He will come for your children. Like, he has no problem blitzing, being aggressive, brilliant defensive mind. I think he'll make him work. But what about the Pitt offense, man? What do we know about Pittsburgh's offense this year?
Too much spread for me. I've watched some of it, and it's with the QB. There's a lot of, like, I think he is one of the worst in the country, or most passes that should have been intercepted that the defense dropped.
Turnover-worthy plays?
Yes, but even just sheer drops of interceptions, not even just the turnover-worthy play. So I think that kind of regresses back to the mean a little bit. Turnovers happen in Syracuse.
By the way, Pittsburgh's undefeated.
Like, yes.
It's kind of crazy, but Pittsburgh has found a way to win close games. And Narduzzi, man,
they've survived.
Yeah, but you know what, though? That's a mark of a good coach. And he's rebuilding every year. Every time you watch people at other schools, you know, you see Pittsburgh receivers, you know, go to USC and win Biletnikoff Awards. And I see their defensive linemen over at Colorado that are good. They always find guys that can rush the passer. They're always blue collar. They make you work it. So he does a really great job with the squad.
Friday night, big G5, non-Power 4, however you want to term it, Boise at UNLV. Anybody going to play any defense in this game?
Nope. And we could see this meeting a couple times.
Yes.
Which is interesting. But, Genty, until otherwise noticed, I am not betting against this guy. Like, he should be right up there in the Heisman discussion. If you have him first, I'm okay with it. If you have him second, fine. Like, if you have him third, but you better have him in the top three. I mean, he's been that kind of good this season, and you get three spots on the ballot. And I'm just telling you, when I put mine in, as of right now, if I put it in, he would be on it. Just the break tackle rate is insane. The carrying the yardage for his team is insane. He's that good. So maybe until otherwise for me, I'm going with Genty.
I'll go with the home team. I'll take the Rebels. And by the way, Ricky White making plays.
Doing well.
As a receiver.
Yeah.
65 or 66 targets, the next most on his team, has 24. So it's all him in terms of that. And then a bunch of games on Saturday. Anything here jump out as a possible upset kind of watch? We got Penn State at Wisconsin, BYU at UCF, who almost beat Iowa State last week, Washington at Indiana, who now plays without Rourke at QB, or Nebraska at Ohio State, which is less of glamour because of what Nebraska did last week.
I'm just really – Indiana's a really good team. And we've talked about them as much as any show in the country probably, and for a number of weeks, and how they're good. They're really good because of their quarterback and because of his ability to get the ball out and his ability to use his eyes. He's gone. I mean, I'm interested if Indiana's a program where they're good enough everywhere else to pick up the slack, because when I look at them, I feel like the QB makes it go, and the QB ain't making it go. He gone. So can Jackson?
He played well in the little bit that he was 7 of 8 for 91 yards and 2 touchdowns against Nebraska, but that was obviously.
It was 28-7 at half. The game was over. It was
far gone conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The game was over.
He started 5 games last year. He was not good last year.
Yeah, and listen, this whole team is new, so not fair, yes. You know, right, like to judge him. And he's got playmakers, they've got running backs, they've got receivers. I thought I was most impressed last week how physical they were on both sides of the line of scrimmage, stopping the run and running the football. And so is the sum bigger than the quarterback spot? And I think that they're going to be challenged. And so I'm interested to find that out, because Indiana still undefeated, and they've got a schedule where – shoot, they've got a chance to really make some hay and maybe get in the playoff.
The other one for me is Penn State.
Yeah.
Just because of what looms for them the following week, because next week is Ohio State at home, like at Wisconsin, night game at Wisconsin. I think I was checking the time. Night game is Wisconsin. You just and they've kind of messed around with some of these teams a little bit more so oftentimes, especially in the past. So that's one for me where it's like, okay, maybe I don't think Wisconsin has enough offensively to do anything, but just because it's familiar foes in the Big Ten. I think that's what's – you look at some of these games in the Big Ten where, hey, now you got Oregon, Washington, USC, you're not used to playing those teams versus, hey, Wisconsin plays Penn State every year and they're used to it, or for the most part.
Yeah.
And when those things happen, coaches know each other, those games oftentimes end up being a little closer.
Yeah. No, they are. And – we wanted to bring in somebody this week to talk about football, and Greg McElroy is one of the smartest analysts by far at ESPN. Like, he loves the game. I love the way he breaks it down. I love how much passion and energy. He never comes in uninformed. And so I got to catch up with him a little bit earlier and talk a little shop. And here it is. All right. Now we're going to welcome in a guest. Greg McElroy played football at Alabama, but I think everybody obviously at this point, Greg is past the Alabama and on to the commentating. I do want to know this, man, obviously great quarterback. And now how did you get into commentate? Like what gave you the jump start into it or what made you even think you wanted to do something like it?
You know, it's funny. It's actually a really interesting story. We were at the NFF Scholar Dinner back in 2010. I was a senior, and we had just played Auburn in like an all-time great game. This was in December of 2010. Auburn goes on to win the SEC. They're playing Oregon for the national championship in January of 11. And Chris Fowler comes up to me, and Herb Street was with him. And I had lost the academic Heisman, which at the time is the Campbell Award, but the Dratty, I mean, all this other stuff. So it's the academic Heisman or whatnot. I had lost it to Sam Acho. So I was all ticked off and I go straight to the bar and like have a couple drinks and those guys are there. And, you know, they're like, hey, you know, it'd be a good idea if you came out and talked about Auburn. You just played them. Like, why don't you come out and talk about them? I'm like, that's fine. I can do it. The game's in Phoenix. I'm training in LA. We can make it happen. So I do, and it went well. And they basically approached my agent saying, hey, if he wants to forego his college career, he can come do TV, or forego his NFL career, he can come do TV right now. And I said, no, I want to scratch that itch. But we kind of stayed in communication. And when they decided to launch the SEC Network, it was kind of the perfect time from a leverage standpoint. I was still under contract with the Bengals, but kind of knew that I had just gotten my pension. Like, I kind of knew that, like, you know, the end was probably near unless I wanted to grind out a couple more. So it ended up being a perfect move. And I haven't regretted it for a second. Like, I don't miss playing at all. Cause I mean, you know, like, you leave a pretty significant void in your life when you don't have that competitive juice. So that now being still in there and still going to games every week and kind of having a team to rely around, that's something that's tough to replicate.
No, no doubt. And we got two things in common from that story, Greg. The Bengals and commentating. The academic Heisman, absolutely not. Wasn't even in the running, still waiting for the paper to get the degree. When you look back to last week, you called the Tennessee-Alabama game. Obviously, it was a great one. Georgia-Texas. Like, this week, what's fresh on your mind, you know, in college football from last week, or something you want to get off your chest, or something you've been thinking about, or something you've been doing on your show?
I don't know about you, man. Like, are you not kind of amazed at the inconsistencies that we're seeing across the board? I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's the depth. The depth everywhere is different now.
It's different, man. And like, you can go from having a really strong opinion of somebody, and all of a sudden the next week, it's like a totally different animal. It's even from like half to half. I mean, I look back at the Georgia-Bama game, you know, right? Pivotal inflection point in the season. And I'm watching Georgia's defense, and they're super aggressive early, overly aggressive probably to a fault. And they're bringing pressures, and Bama's got an answer for everything. I mean, they're three or four steps ahead on everything. Jalen's playing decisively. He's cutting it loose. He's accurate. They're hitting downfield throws. It's like, man, this is something. And then you watch the second half offense, and it's like, all right, hang on a second. They're not doing the right thing on zone reads. They're not doing a good job on the jet sweep reads. Like, they're not. What happened to the group we saw in the first 30 minutes? Now they hit a deep ball, they score, they win the game, and they survive. But it was like from one half to the next, like, what was that? For Georgia on the other side, it's like they can be that bad defensively in the first half. I know that there was a turnover that, you know, didn't help matters. But they can give up that many plays downfield. And they, by the way, they couldn't apply pressure and they kept getting outflanked defensively. Like they got problems on defense. That's the takeaway, right? And then you fast forward to the game against Texas with an offensive line that's really experienced and Texas couldn't block them. It just, I just don't understand how we can see inconsistencies like that from week to week. And while I understand, like, this is a different world, like, when we played, you had to be at your best in some cases week one. For some teams, that was the toughest team they played was their non-conference game week one. And now it's going to be kind of a gradual improvement for a lot of these teams so that you're peaking in December and January. But that, to me, has been really strange because as soon as you draw a conclusion about somebody or some team, it might not necessarily be a conclusion that you can lean into for the next several weeks.
Yeah. And, you know, despite what Kirby Smart said this weekend, you thought Georgia would win. And you picked, you know, Georgia, even though everybody else on the airways were leaning Texas. What did you see going into that football game that you thought Georgia could win?
I thought, you know, what's funny is I thought they'd win, but I didn't think it'd look anything the way it looked. I thought this was going to be, all right, hey, Carson Beck, who cares? Like, you're the underdog. Cut it loose. You got nothing to lose at this point. Like, you have already at this point been a little shaky, you know, by your standards. Haven't been as good throwing the football. Haven't been as decisive. Haven't cut it loose. I mean, I remember if you watched multiple times, I mean, there's guys running free that would likely be big plays for Georgia. And he hadn't even looked in that direction. He was immediately getting through it too quickly and getting to a check down. So it was a little bit like, all right, he's going to just uncork here. Like, if their offensive line can hold up, which Texas has a really good pass rush, if their offensive line can hold up, this Texas secondary hasn't seen anything like this. So I think the catch and runs and some of the things that they could do from a shot play standpoint was going to give them the win. That wasn't the case at all. If anything, it was very much the opposite. The Georgia offense was a significant black eye on what was a flawless defensive performance. I mean, you look at the drive starts. I mean, you look at the field position. I mean, all that stuff. It was hard not to score, you know, in those circumstances. So I thought Georgia would win because of big game experience and they'd create a lot of explosives in the passing game, and that wasn't the case at all. But the defense kind of showed, all right, hey, we're still here. Like, you give us chances to win one-on-ones, we're going to win them. And they did time and time again, and the edge defenders took over the game. So really, really impressive performance, and one that I think you can absolutely build on to becoming the top team in college football if you're Georgia.
Yeah, no doubt. And this is Greg McElroy joining us, obviously, always college football. Nicholas Pollack, my son, he's now upset, Greg, when he's like, I don't like when I get to the car and I don't have one to listen to. So he comes home from football practice most of the time, and he'll sit in his car for a little bit. I'm like, what are you doing? He was like, well, Greg was finishing the podcast. And I'm like, have you ever listened to mine, bud? He was like, no, absolutely not. So
he gets to talk to you every day. That's cool.
It's good work, apparently, if you've got a 16-year-old and he continues to listen. So I would recommend everybody listen. All right, Greg, I have a rule change. I'm so sick and tired. So we did the Dan Lanning rule change, right? In the middle of the season. We're okay with changing that rule like that at the drop of the hat.
Right.
Okay, I'm so sick and tired of targeting, so I propose a rule change. If an offensive player lowers his head and targets a defensive player, you need to be kicked out as well. If you initiate helmet to helmet, why is it always the defensive player that gets punished?
Yeah. It's fair. I mean, there's no pushing back on it. They're not going to make the game less safe. So reeling back the targeting foul is not something that I think they're in a real hurry to do. I am encouraged though, David, and I know you look at it from a defender's perspective, and to see offensive targeting, I think would be an appropriate addendum to the rule. Like, you wouldn't find any pushback from me. Especially considering it's ball carrier safety. I'm okay with that. But one thing I am encouraged by, I did the Ole Miss LSU game a couple weeks ago, and Ole Miss had a wide receiver that was running to his right. It might have been the quarterback. It was the quarterback. It was Jackson Dart. He's rolling to his right. He initiates his slide. And Whit Weeks, who is a super talented linebacker for LSU and the guy that frankly won the game for LSU in that game, probably their best defensive player or close to it, if certainly in the mix with Braden Swenson. So he's been amazing. He's going in to tackle Jackson Dart. His head is, you know, he doesn't drop his head. He's trying to see it, but Jackson Dart slides, so he lowers his target. And boom, I mean, his helmet hits Jackson Dart, who's initiating a slide. So I'm like, oh, shoot, well, we might have a defenseless player here, you know, because at what point does the slide initiate? I think there's some gray area there. And it does look like there's an indicator because he does lower his head just a little bit. Now, the replay reviewed said, you know what? No, it's not targeting. Let's keep him in the game because it's pretty clear. Like if you know ball, you can kind of judge intent, right? I mean, was the guy trying to form tackle or not? Yes or no? And I know that they always say, well, you know, we don't want to go down the rabbit hole of intent, But I think we need to have layers to the rule. Like there should be a targeting one and a targeting two. Targeting two is clearly a guy is disregarding the rules, get him out. And this guy is trying to do the right thing. It's, quote, circumstantial targeting. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I want them to kind of evaluate that in the future because that, I think, would be an appropriate use of changing the rule book. Because I don't want to see guys lose playing time when they're trying to do it the right way. I mean, you were a defender. I knew when you were headhunting, right? Or am I wrong?
Yeah. And listen, the problem with that, too, is, man, like, this is what we – so here's the solution to me. This is very simple. It's just like basketball. Like, if you throw a punch and you deck somebody, get him the heck out of the game. It's a flagrant two. Like, this is very simple. If it's a flagrant one and he's going to the bucket and playing basketball, like, if you're playing football and you're going to try to make a play and you're not when you're defenseless, dude, have at it. But when you're a ball carrier and you're lowering your shoulder and you're creating contact and changing a level – there has to be something in there that we work so dang hard all week, all year to sit out games, dude. We only get so many opportunities, and I can't swallow that.
I'm fine with it. I mean,
all right.
But we've changed behavior enough. Like, as much as people want to complain about the targeting rule, I will admit, like, I don't think we've had a targeting. We've done 7-8 games now this year, and I don't think we've had a targeting in any of our games. So I do think that we have changed behavior and we have changed the rule a little bit to where there's a little more wiggle room because you have to have the indicator now, which is helpful.
And I'm with you because I was like, man, why don't we put a dress on these guys? We're getting so soft. But you're watching and now you're seeing people be safe and you're like, this is exactly the point. We've changed habits. Like now you're seeing a shoulder being lowered. All right, couple questions for you. Who's the non-group of four team? Who's the team outside that you think has the best chance? I mean, you're looking at Navy and Army who are undefeated, which is awesome stories. And by the way, they have passing attacks, which is weird because they're efficient. They're very efficient in it. You've got UNLV and you've got Boise. So there's a bunch of choices, or would you go off the board and go somewhere else?
Boise UNLV is going to be interesting this week. Obviously, it might be the first of two meetings between the two teams. I kind of lean UNLV. In this game, which is going to be really interesting. I think it's going to be a high-scoring affair. If Boise can rush the passer and make Haj Malik Williams uncomfortable, then that's tricky. I think Boise got like 30 sacks this year, some absurd number. So that's something they do extremely well, and it's not like Haj Malik Williams has like a ton of starts under his belt at UNLV after the Slukas situation to feel comfortable and have answers to the test. So something worth watching. I think UNLV could certainly get that one this week. I'm doing Navy Notre Dame this week, and I'm super impressed with what I've seen from Navy's offense. Now, here's the thing. Like I've seen American teams for a long time, and I think the American from top to bottom has traditionally been the best in the G5. Now I look at it and I'm not as sure because of some of the teams that have departed the American for the Big 12. I think Mountain West is slightly above as far as depth and quality, but I really like Navy's passing attack. I love how they utilize a bunch of different looks. Like they'll sub the, like, I don't know how much tape you've watched. It's really interesting, but like I've pulled plays for like a telestration this week where we show them in a traditional wing T veer alignment, like traditional wings, fullback, split backs, right? Like traditional look. And then they shift to empty shotgun. It's like, hang on a second. I've just had a play called designed to stop the fullback. And now I got to account for that fullback running a jerk route on a middle linebacker. Like, I mean, what do you do? Do you pressure it? Do you play coverage? I mean, it's kind of a game of cat and mouse. So, and Blake Horvat, their quarterback's done a really nice job of being good in the pocket, moving in the pocket. And dude, they'll throw the kitchen sink. Like I watched the Memphis game. Memphis is probably the most talented team they've played up to this point. I mean, double passes, throwbacks, like Philly specials, like halfback passes, like they don't care. I mean, they'll throw the kitchen sink at them. So that'll be an interesting game this weekend against Notre Dame. It's just, are they going to be physical enough defensively to hold up in the trenches? That's the big question for me.
Yeah. You see him running, pulling the left guard, left tackle, running QB counter, reading it like so much different than you've seen in
QB
the past.
Counter with like speed option off of it. It's like, this is insane.
Well, and so you, I mean, you, and again, it cuts the whole feel. It makes you play. It makes you play basketball. It makes you play man-to-man coverage, basically. Like that's right. What sucks playing those type of a teams. How good is Genty, man? Like I've seen a lot of backs. You've been around a lot of backs. You've seen all those Alabama guys all these years. Like, how good is that cat?
He's a dude now. I mean, he's big time, big time. And I know, like, people have said, well, look at the level of competition. I mean, he's running through guys that are not, you know, quite as physically imposing. It's like, dude, I don't care. Watch him in the open field. Like, look how shifty he is. He's got some Sproles. He's got some Sproles wiggle, but he can run with power. I mean, I don't know how, like, you've seen a ton of good backs. Like, I mean, I've been around a lot of guys that can play a lot of really high-level football. Like, he reminds me of LaDainian Tomlinson. Like, he's stronger than you realize, but he's got great wiggle and he's decent catching it out of the backfield. Like, that's who he reminds me of. And LT obviously played at TCU in a time when TCU was not considered to be, you know, top flight competition back in the, you know, late 90s. But when I watch him, that's the first guy I think of. And, like, to me, in my generation, I don't know about you, DP, like, the best running back, the two best running backs are Adrian Peterson and LaDainian Tomlinson. And like I said, I grew up like high school in 2006. So, I mean, Sean Alexander, had he had a slightly longer career, might have been a little bit different. But if you're getting compared to LT, like you're doing something right. I think that's who he reminds me of, really.
Yeah. And when you say that, by the way, and that's Greg McElroy with us, by the way, ESPN, ABC, Always College Football. I think the crazy thing is people say they haven't played anybody. He had 200 yards against Oregon. Like, and by the way, passing Greg, they had 150. So it ain't like they've had a ton of balance. Like, you know where the ball's going, and he's still been historic. All right, I got something. You did this for me.
About that Oregon game, like, I had a guy trying to defend Oregon's rush defense against Ohio State, which they obviously fared very well. But we had a guy defending Oregon's rush defense against Ohio State, and he's like, well, I'm like, well, what about Genty? I mean, Genty ran for a 192 or whatever. He goes, yeah, but, I mean, if you look at the game, he had, like, you know, he really didn't average a lot. They really held him in check. Like, most of his carries went for less than 5 yards, and then he hit the 170-yarder. I'm like, that's what he does, though. Like, it's like, I mean, don't get me wrong, if it might make it and he, okay, but he had 12 carries for 60 yards, then he hit a 70-yarder. I'm like, exactly. That's why he's a beast, because he always hits that 70-yarder. It's absurd.
Those don't count. Those don't. It's just it's the one lucky one. Considering, by the way, and in that game, Oregon had two special teams touchdowns. Otherwise, Oregon probably loses that football game. All right, you did something like this with me. I want to do it with you real quick, and I'll let you get out of here. Two questions. This is gonna be two part, but first we'll start here. SEC. Give me the top four or five. Give me the top five teams in the SEC moving forward that you think, because obviously eight teams ranked, there's still a lot of teams that can do damage. A&M and LSU are first and second in the rankings because they have no losses, which is crazy, but they are. So what are the top five to you in the SEC?
Well, let's do the top five I wouldn't want to play. Let's do that. Does that sound good? Because I'd look at the order right now, and to me it's not representative of how good those teams are or are capable of being. Number one to me is Georgia. Number two is Texas. Number three, and this will shock many, is probably LSU. I just think LSU's, they got two pass rushers off the edge that scare me to death. They got a linebacker in Whit Weeks that's getting better. They got a secondary that's getting older and now has gotten better with Zy Alexander's return. And a passing attack that really has had no help by way of the run game. So if the run game gets going behind an offensive line that I think has its best football in front of it, like, they can beat you a lot of different ways. So they'd be three. Number four would be Tennessee. Similar, like, they can rush the passer. They got guys that could take over the game. They're deep on defense. And the thing about their off, like, Sampson's a dude now. Like, I love Dylan Sampson. That guy should be on everyone's All-American list. He's the best back I've seen this year in person. I haven't seen Genty in person. I haven't seen, you know, Jeremiah Love in person. I haven't seen these guys in person yet, but he's the best back I've seen in person this year. And then people are like, well, he misses deep balls. Like, okay, well, if he hits two, it's Katie bar the door. It's a wrap. You know, you hit two a game and you try six, like, you're cooking. Tennessee would be five. And then or four, and then number six. Number six right now, I still
five.
Yeah, number five. It's a toss up. Like, people are gonna push back on this, but I still think Alabama is so dangerous. Like, I just think if you catch them, the defense I think has played a little bit better last week against Tennessee. I think the linebackers are getting more comfortable. I'm encouraged by what I've seen along the defensive front. And then I'm optimistic that this secondary is only going to get better after the bye week and they get a little healthier. So I think Bama, their ceiling is still high because of Jalen Milroe. If Jalen Milroe can get back to playing the way he played against Georgia, they're cooking. And I think they got to take some of the pressure off of it with the run game. But I still put Bama five. But, man, it's hard to leave Ole Miss out. Like, I look at Ole Miss talent. Golly,
especially defensively and how much they've improved.
I mean, I'm telling you, like, I think Ole Miss is legit, man. Like, I did both their losses, and they had no business losing either game. I mean, none at all. So, Ole Miss, I know A&M's right there, but I don't know. I'm not
there on A&M yet, I can tell.
The consistencies with Wigman just concern me. You know what I mean? Like, am I going to get the version of Wigman that played against Mizzou? Or am I going to get the version of Wigman that played against Mississippi State? You know what I mean? Because that's a very different performance from one to the other.
And Notre Dame really struggled in Notre Dame the first game. So that's fair. I mean, the consistency, you know, hasn't been there. I think the thing about Bama is I see Milroe, and sometimes obviously he's the ultimate baseball guy, right? He can hit home runs and he's going to strike out. Like, he's going to have so many misses that you just go, why? Like, why do you miss that? The thing that worries me most about Bama is, like, penalties consistently. Like, stupid penalties, turnovers that are unforgivable, interceptions in the end zones, like fumbles against South Florida. Like, it feels like it's always something, Greg. It feels to me like, you know, just like Law, the last part of that game, you can't throw that punch. Like, you cannot do that. And so listen, Nick retired, I know, and Nick's the greatest of all time, but – it feels like the discipline, you know, you bring in a different coach who's a player's coach. It definitely feels different. He's a good coach, and I'm still going to give him credit. And by the way, there's still guys that are open that Jalen Milroe's missing. So I don't think he's a bad coach, but I do think the discipline and the penalties are way up, and that's something that's concerning when I watch Alabama.
I think that's fair, especially like the I think all of us know the difference between, you know, effort penalties, and a lot of us know the difference between – you know, just mistakes and penalties that are pre-snap that are just dumb, you know, after the whistle or before the whistle penalties. Like, you just can't have those. The one thing I would say about that, though, is if you look back, I think there is this preconceived notion about Alabama and who they were under Nick Saban that I think is a little inaccurate. If you look at
they were losing some of that along the last couple of years.
It was trending in that direction. Like, from 2021 to 2023, they were 111th in penalties per game. This year they're 127th. So it's worse. There's no denying that it's worse, but it was already triple dig. Or we like to say triple dig. Like, if triple dig is bad, if you're in the hundreds
bad
rankings, triple dig, not good. Triple dig penalties in the last 3 years under Nick Saban. And two of the three, they were, you know, SEC champs or in the mix for SEC championship, you know? So it's hard to wrap your head around, but it is a concerning trend that I think needs to get alleviated soon.
Last question, I promise. And this one, I think this will be, I know you and I know the way you watch tape and I know the way you know football. I think this will surprise people, but it's not going to surprise me. Who's the best quarterback in the SEC? You need one guy, one game. Who's your guy in the SEC?
One guy, one game, got to have it situation. Garrett Nussmeier.
Me too.
Yeah.
100%.
If I got to have it.
Tell me why.
He's like the honey badger, dude. He doesn't care. I'll tell you who's second.
Who's second?
Diego Pavia.
Pavia. By the way, I would probably go Pavia second as well, which is crazy because we got Quinn Ewers and Carson Beck, who we're talking about possibly being the number one pick in the draft.
We're not playing NFL.
By the way, I still wouldn't put one of those two guys next because I still would rather have Milroe's playmaking ability third.
But it's not. We're not talking about NFL. We're not talking about where you're going to be in 2028. You know, I'm talking about if I got to have it this weekend, like you tell me I got to win a game and I need to have a dude that can help me do that, to execute my offense and to play within the system and to extend plays and to make timely throws and to just play, you know, with a, you know, big bag of knuckles at quarterback.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, if you're catching my drift, like I need a dude that's just going to, I don't care. I'm throwing caution to the wind. I'm going to rip it. And if I throw a pick, who cares? I'm coming back. I'm going to keep ripping it and they're going to learn to like it. And guess what? I might throw three picks, but I'm going down in a blaze of glory because I might throw three touchdowns too. I think Nussmeier is big time. And I think in time he's going to be the, I mean, he's already close. Dude, they have no run game. I mean, they've had run game most of the year and the offense is yet, and they just continue to chip away at it. He's had receivers that have been out. They haven't even had their best deep threat yet. Like Hilton hasn't played. So they're close, I think, to have, I mean, they developed some other guys and who've stepped up, and Aaron Anderson stepped up, and Mason Taylor, their tight end, stepped up. So, like, I'm really optimistic. I love that kid. I think he's the real deal. Now, I do think he could run into a game where he throws four picks. Yeah, that could happen. But he's also not a guy that I want to see on the field with my defense on the field with a four-point lead, because I think he can go down and win it for his offense.
Absolute stones, arm angles, intelligence. Greg, he's been pressured 65 times, and he's taken one sack. Like, I think we don't compare him to Lamar and those guys that can really run, but he knows how to get out of trouble. He doesn't put the ball in harm's way a ton. He's clutch. He's the number one quarterback that's going to be in this draft, which I think is nuts talking about before it's all said and done. So, Hey, man, I appreciate you. Love watching you. Always have. Always been a huge fan of who you are as a person and the way you watch tape, the way you study. I'm going to try to get my son. This is my way to get my son to listen to my show. I got Greg on the show, Nicholas.
This is great, buddy. I'm proud of you, man. I've always appreciate your friendship and always appreciate your perspective.
All right. Have a good one, Greg.
See you, buddy.
Hey, everybody, real quick. We have something that we love to invite you into that you could help us with. It's called the Banquet of Blessings, November 24th, PollockFamilyFoundation.com. You can find all the details, but we feed the homeless. We serve those in need. We're going to bus some in, and we're going to basically open the doors, throw a huge Thanksgiving feast, and along with that will come so many things with coats and hats and scarves and all kinds of stuff that we're going to give to them. It's an awesome event. We would love to have you guys support in any way, shape, or form. Thanks again to Greg, and we'll continue to I'll continue to bring some guests in, some buddies, some coaches as we go along with keep having the doc, because he keeps bringing the good stuff. He's a real doctor, actually. His wife will get upset with that. But no, I mean, Brent, appreciate you. And I think it's going to be a fun weekend. We're going to have some separation. We won't have 34 teams anymore. If you like the show, man, we are all college football, you know, probably very little nonsense. Like, we're not going to do much, man, but like, subscribe. And if you don't, it's all good. We will be here this weekend to discuss this weekend's action.